From the Old City, a practical Torah commentary by Gutman Lodge. Practical Torah means applying the Torah's ancient teachings to our daily lives. This is its ultimate practicality. The Torah has guided the Jewish people for thousands of years. In fact, it is hard to imagine a Jewish people surviving without it. Certainly, the Jews who have cast it aside have few, if any, Jewish descendants. This publication is a collection of comments, explanations, or stories for each of the weekly Torah readings. The common thread running through them is that the Torah is speaking not only of the historical perspective, indeed it is also a history book, but, even more importantly, it is also speaking about each of us today. This timelessness is its true value. It is my prayer that this book will encourage you to apply the practical teachings of the Torah and live the spiritual life that is your true inheritance. When you find it, you will find your path joyful and your life satisfying. Indeed, you will become rich with the most precious things that life has to offer. The Book of Exodus, Sefer Shmot. Exodus 1, Shmot. The Jew and the Torah. This week we begin the book of Exodus, the story of the exile and redemption of the Jewish people. As we look over the five books of Moshe, we see not only the history of the world and the Jewish people as a nation, but we also see the description of our own spiritual lives. The story begins with the creation of the world, the first man and his descendants. Later come the Jewish people, and the tribes of Yaakov are born. Next is their descent into Egypt and their ensuing slavery. After many years, their redemption finally comes. The amazing revelation at Sinai follows, and then we follow their wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. Finally comes their ascent into the land of Israel. This is not only the history of the Jewish nation, it is also the story of our individual spiritual journey today. The biblical story begins with creation, and so does ours. We went through our own individual equivalent of the 6 days of creation while being formed in the womb. The same ingredients that form the world form us. Just as Adam was placed in the Garden of Eden, so were we placed in the garden. We grew up there, and as children we innocently played in that garden. Maybe we tended sheep or did other simple tasks that children are able to do. Our lives are almost entirely wrapped around our families. This part of our national history is found in the book of Genesis, which also describes the beginning stages of our individual lives. Then, as the tribes matured, so did we. We became adults. And just like the adults in the biblical story, we too faced famine. We have to eat and provide for our needs. We have to go to work. This is our descent into Egypt. Mystically, Egypt is the land of limitations. In Hebrew, the words Egypt, Mitzrayim, and limitation, Matzah, share the same root, Mem, Sadi, Resh. Egypt restricts our freedom, but it also provides us with the means of gaining a livelihood. Simply put, this means work. Now, if this work is merely to provide for our physical needs, it may very well become our purpose in life. Work can even become our sole reason for living. After all, we must work to live. We have to eat and buy things to sustain our families. So we go to work to provide for these needs. But as the material aspect of life becomes more and more important to us, we can easily lose sight of any higher purpose in life, and sadly, the material perspective becomes our sole goal. This focus on materialism persists even after we are fortunate to have enough to sustain ourselves for the foreseeable future. And even after it begins to hurt us, we still go to work every day. The work has already enslaved our thinking. No matter how much we do, no matter how much we earn, the master always demands more. The slavery becomes bitter, life becomes drudgery, and although it is almost unbearable, this way of life is all we know. Work pushes us harder, and although we do not like it, we firmly believe that this is what we are supposed to be doing. Then we finally call out to God for help. Where did that idea come from? The idea of a spiritual possibility dawns, a purpose beyond the sheer physical. Maybe even the thought of freedom from slavery dawns. Could this be possible? We struggle and, with God's help, finally throw off the bonds of slavery and go out into freedom. We go out into the wilderness without physical security. We imagine an entirely spiritual life. We would be there without any visible means of support, but we're determined to search for God's ways. Somehow, we will be supported even there. After the first great revelation, we wander through the desert, learning his ways, the ups and downs of spiritual living, and then finally, with his help, we are brought up into the land of Israel itself. Once we are in Israel, which is our homeland, we engage both the spiritual and the physical aspects of life. But now the physical does not enslave us because we no longer think it is the purpose of life. The physical becomes a mere tool in our hands that we use in order to fulfill our higher spiritual goals. We have learned that the spiritual, not the physical, is the purpose of life. This is the story written in the Bible, but more importantly, it is also the story of each of us. It is a story of our conception, physical development in the womb, birth, becoming adults, going to work, finding drudgery, seeking a higher purpose, disdaining the physical, discovering the Torah, and finally ascending to the land of Israel to live out our days, enjoying both the physical and spiritual blessings that God bestows on us. And this is the true value of the Torah. It is talking to us about us. Did God tell a lie? With this week's portion of the Torah, we begin the long journey of darkness into dire slavery, and finally, our exodus into freedom. After Yosef's passing, a new pharaoh is in power, and he fears the prolific and prosperous Jewish people. His solution is to enslave them and to make their slavery bitter. God sends Moshe to lead his people out of this cruel slavery. He tells him to tell Pharaoh that God met with him, and he is to let the Jewish people go into the wilderness for 3 days to worship him. Now, God knew perfectly well what was going to happen. He knew that he was sending the Jewish people out into freedom, never again to return to Egypt. So how could he tell Moshe to lie to Pharaoh? God's name is Truth. He is the Truth. So how could he have sent Moshe to apparently tell an untruth? When God told Moshe to tell Pharaoh that the Jews were going to leave for 3 days, he was simply doing to Pharaoh exactly what Pharaoh had done to the Jews. It was only fair, and mita kenega mita, that God should treat him as he had treated the Jews. When Pharaoh ordered the enslavement of the Jewish people, he did not send his soldiers to immediately enslave them. He first had the Jews work for the so-called community good. There was the ruse that the Jews were going to work along with the Egyptians to help improve their host country. It was in the national interest that the store cities be built, and it was only fitting that all of the residents of the state share in this communal endeavor. Then slowly Egyptians begin to walk away from the backbreaking work. But when a Jew would try to walk away, there were guards there to push him back. Then, little by little, the real slavery began. Little by little, it became darker and darker. Pharaoh demanded harsher and harsher treatment, until even commanding the murder of all the Jewish and even non-Jewish male babies. Now, what does this have to do with us today? The Torah is to be studied from at least 4 main perspectives, which when combined become 13 different perspectives that can be used to better understand its meaning. The main perspectives are the literal, the allegorical, the interpretive, and the mystical, or secret, underlying perspective. Obviously, each of these will tell a different story, but none of these stories will contradict any of the other stories. From each perspective, we learn different truth. Simply stated, the literal perspective of the slavery and the exodus from Egypt is the narration of actually what happened to the various characters in the story. This is simply the literal historical perspective. What we read really happened to those people. One of the main allegorical stories we can learn from the Exodus is to understand that the Torah is also speaking of a man being enslaved by his physical work. Man can either work entirely for the physical benefit, or he can work for its spiritual benefit. When he works merely for the physical, he has become a slave to his work. His slavery will get harsher and harsher, and no matter how much success he has, he will become more and more entrenched in his slavery. And oh, is this a bitter slavery. His physical master, be it lust for wealth, power, or fame, is clutching him like a vice. His own enslaving desire constantly demands, do more, get more. His slavery becomes darker and darker. It is only when he finally cries out to God and endeavors to seek spiritual life that his slavery begins to end. Certainly, if he will work as hard on his spiritual life as he did for his physical life, he will be able to completely leave the cruel king who was enslaving him. The interpretive perspective draws upon the main story and applies these teachings to other teachings. So, for instance, we are taught that the bricks the Jews were forced to make in Egypt and the mortar they had to mix with back-breaking labor actually point to the remedy for the slavery. Bricks, in Hebrew, is pronounced levanim. This is similar to the word to understand, lahavin. Freedom comes with true understanding. Mortar is pronounced chomer. One of the most common Talmudic phrases used to analyze two comparative items is all the more so. This is pronounced kal vachomer. Studying the Torah elevates the bricks and mortars of slavery to become the building blocks and mortar of spiritual freedom. Here we see that the very things that were physically enslaving us must be used in a spiritual way in order to go out into freedom. The exact tools of our slavery become the tools of our freedom. When Moshe tells Pharaoh to let the Jewish people go, Pharaoh yells at him, "Behold, the people of the land are now numerous, and you will have them cease from their burdens?" Without changing any of the words, this same sentence could be read, "Behold, the ignorant people are now numerous, and you are going to give them Shabbat rest from their burdens." The cruel voice of the enslaving master can be seen to be prophesying. Moshe, you are going to give the people Shabbat. Right in the deepest darkness, the dawn is coming. Here is the greatest teaching of the Exodus. We must learn how to turn the binding evil inclination into the uplifting good inclination. From the mystical perspective, this is the story of each of our individual souls' descent into a body, into their own personal limitations. The Hebrew word for Egypt means to shut or limit. This is what happens to the soul when it comes into the world. When the soul looks out at the physical world through physical eyes, it sees only physicality. It even comes so far down into its personal Egypt that it believes that it too is physical. It forgets its lofty nature and its holy purpose and pursues the physical pursuits of the world. This is the soul's descent into Egypt. It is only when the soul remembers and directs its physical limitations to serve the spirituality does it begin to experience the freedom it seeks, even while it is still locked in a physical body. Exodus 6:2, Vayera, Hashem, the name. In this week's portion of the Torah, God told Moshe that he is appearing to him as the one whose name is Hashem. But he appeared to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov only as the one whose name signifies sufficient. The name that represents Hashem is the highest manifestation of any of his names. But the Torah clearly states that Hashem appeared to Avram and to Yitzchak. So what does he mean now when he says that he did not appear to them as Hashem? Hashem appeared to the forefathers as the one and only God. This was a tremendous revelation because at that time the entire world believed that there were many gods, as do the majority of people alive today. But now Moshe was learning something more. He was being shown that not only is Hashem one, and not only is he the only God, actually he is the only one who exists at all. This higher perspective was not revealed to the forefathers. Even to say that God is one is not such a simple teaching. We must understand that although he has many names, and each name represents a unique aspect or function of God, still he is a constant single one. But the idea that Hashem is all there is a much more difficult teaching to understand. After all, aren't we here too? Since the Torah is saying that he is all, is this really saying that we are him? The entire creation, the higher and the lower, are constantly being created each instant by Hashem's will. The creation is his will, and he and his will are one. As an analogy, it is as if God, with his breath, is blowing creation into being, and he and his breath are one. The creation is actually his voice, as he says, "Let there be." So although we are his creation, we are not simply his creation. Rather, the entire creation, including us, is an actual aspect of him. The concept that God is all is found in many places in the Torah, but is almost always hidden, as it is the deepest mystery of all. A primary source that reveals this concept is, "Know this day, and take it to your heart, that the Lord is God. In the heavens above and upon the earth below, there is nothing else." The name Yud-Keh-Vav-Keh. This name of Hashem signifies the entire existence as the one who was, is, and will be. Its actual pronunciation has been lost, perhaps intentionally, to prevent abuse. Even though we do not know its true pronunciation, and therefore could not misuse the actual name, still we do not even try to pronounce it. This prevents any possibility of profaning it. On Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when the temple was standing, the high priest would pronounce this name as it is actually spelled, and all who were present would fall to their faces and prostrate themselves before the one God, who revealed his presence in that holy place. The written letters of this name actually form a diagram of this aspect of God. Hashem, literally the name, usually refers to God, but here we are referring to the actual name. The Yud signifies the upper realm, as the entire letter is written only in the upper area of the line. According to the Kabbalah, the letter K signifies the revelation of self through giving. So the K, following the upper letter, the Yud, signifies the revelation of the self through giving of the higher existence that the Yud represents. The K is shaped like a house or structure, so it represents the revelation of what is readily found, or being. The Vav signifies the drawing down of the Yud, since its shape is actually a downward continuation of the Yud. The final K, like the first K, means the revelation of self through giving. But here, since it is following the Vav, it signifies the revelation of the self-giving, that which is drawn down and being the lower existence, that is, the lower structure. The first two letters diagram the revelation of the higher existence, and the last two letters diagram the revelation of the lower existence, the manifested creation. The name shows, as if pictographically, that Hashem is the one and only in the upper existence and the one and only in the lower existence. He is revealing an aspect of himself by becoming both the upper, unmanifested worlds and the lower, actualized worlds. This name shows that he is all that exists at any level. To our forefathers and to those who follow in their ways, he showed himself as the one who is sufficient, the one who provides for all of our needs. To Moshe and to those who follow Moshe in the Kabbalah, he shows himself not only as the sufficient one, but also as the only. It's only magic. In this week's portion of the Torah, God assures Moshe that everything will turn out as he said it would. He commands Moshe to appear before Pharaoh to tell him to let the Jewish people go so they may worship him. He also tells Moshe that when Pharaoh asks for proof that indeed it is God who is commanding this, Moshe is to have his brother Aaron throw down his staff, which will become a snake. Moshe does as God commands him. Pharaoh sees Aaron's snake, and he calls upon his magicians and sorcerers. They chant their magical formulas, and they also produce snakes. And even though Aaron's staff, his snake, eats the sorcerer's staffs, their snakes, Pharaoh still considers this to simply be another form of magic, and he hardens his heart. From this episode, we can learn the answer to a deep mystery that happened hundreds of years before this scene took place. When Avram sent the children he fathered with Keturah away from Yitzchak, the text tells us that he gave them gifts. Our sages explain that these gifts were unclean powers. Avram loved all of his children dearly and wanted only good for them. So why then did he give them these unclean powers? The Torah says that Avram gave everything that he had to his son Yitzchak while he was still alive, and to the sons of the concubine that he had, he gave them gifts and sent them away eastward. First, we must ask, if Abram gave everything he had to Yitzchak, what then did he have left to give to the children he was sending away? The answer is, Abram did give everything he had to Yitzchak, but the property he inherited from his wife, Sarah, he gave to those other children. When Avimelech kidnapped and then released Sarah, he gave her these powers and other gifts to show that he did not molest her. Avram did not want his son Yitzchak to have such unclean things, but he knew that he was sending his other children to a land where this power already existed. If these children were sent to that land without these wondrous powers, and they had seen these powers in the hands of the eastern magicians and sorcerers, they would have become servants to them. But since they too had these powers, when the sorcerers tried to impress them with their mystical deeds, these children would simply say, "It's only magic. See, we can do it too." And this is why Pharaoh was not impressed with Aaron's wonder, and why he needed more and more signs until he would finally give up. But just a minute. Didn't God say to Moshe when he first sent him to Pharaoh that he was going to harden Pharaoh's heart? If so, what choice did Pharaoh have? How could it be that so many disastrous signs and wonders came upon him, and still he would not give up? Surely if it were not for God having hardened his heart, any normal ruler would have given up long before. So did Pharaoh have any choice at all in the matter? If God was hardening his heart, what could he have done? In truth, Pharaoh had long ago hardened his heart to the cries of the Jewish people he so cruelly enslaved. He did not listen when their mothers cried out for mercy for their sons' lives, and now God was returning to him just what he had done to the Jews. But why did God send the wonder to Pharaoh in the form of a snake? He could have turned a staff into any number of things. Every time the Torah uses the same word in two places, it is suggesting that they might have something in common. This is true of all repetitions of the Torah, whether they be words, letters, or numbers. The Torah cannot use the word blue to mean one thing here and a totally different thing somewhere else. And although each usage may have its own unique qualities, it would be unfair to call something red if it really was blue. Therefore, we should look at the original usage of the word or concept snake and see what we can apply to Moshe and his staff. We see that in the garden, it was the snake that convinced Chava, Eve, to eat of the forbidden fruit. He told her that when she does eat of it, she will see that she is like God. Pharaoh taught his people that he was actually God. So now this very snake that had led mankind through Chava to see that they are like God has come to the man who said he is God. By now, this far into the story, we have to ask ourselves that if we see that the limitations of Egypt are slavery, how then are we to live in the physical world? How are we to provide for ourselves? How do we support our families and not become slaves? Pharaoh would give a stipend to his priest. It was from this money that they survived. Are we to become wards of the state in order to be free to serve God? In the description of the plague that God sent against Egypt's cattle, there's an obvious hint that answers this important question. How do we go out into freedom from our own personal Egypt and still survive in the physical world? God told Moshe to say, God shall distinguish between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt. Livestock is a metaphor for wealth. In those days, a man's wealth was measured by how many sheep he had. When flocks are accumulated, while having served only the physical goal, as Egypt's flocks were gathered, then the possessions actually end up owning the possessor. But when the goal is spiritual, so the physical is used merely as a tool to accomplish the spiritual goal, then God makes a distinction between these two flocks. To explain, when you are on your way to do a mitzvah, all of the steps on the way are also part of that mitzvah. And the opposite is also true. That is, if you are going to work merely to make money for its own sake, then you will eventually become enslaved by your own desires. Possessions that have not been tithed are forbidden for use. These possessions have the holy tithe spread throughout them. This holiness can be used only for entirely holy purposes and not as mundane possessions can be used. Possessions that have not been tithed are like the flocks of Pharaoh. They are gathered without concern for the holiness that is inherent within all things. But if you are going to work to make money, even the very job that the Egyptian slave did, so that you can acquire the proceeds in order to do a good deed, then that same work becomes holy work. If you're going to work to make money to support a righteous family, to pay for Jewish education, to have guests on Shabbos, to build a sukkah, or whatever good deed you wish to do, then that work becomes holy work. Once you set aside the minimum, required 10% of your income for charity, this removes the forbidden holy fruit from the 90% and renders it permissible. This remainder is not merely permissible, but since it generated and provided the holy 10%, it now assumes its own elevated spiritual status. Because the holiness of the tithe has been removed, the remainder assumes the status of an object that has served the holy object, and as such, has its own unique level of holiness. These are the flocks of Israel. Exodus 10, Bo. What's so bad about leavening? In this week's portion of the Torah, God continues to slam Egypt with plague after plague until Pharaoh gives up and allows the Jewish people to leave. In preparation for freedom, God begins to give the first of the many commandments that he has entrusted to the Jewish people. The word Torah comes from the root meaning instruction, and now begins the many detailed instructions to the Jewish people as to how to live a Jewish spiritual life. One of the very first commandments given teaches us how to conduct the Passover Seder. In addition to the requirements that apply only to the Seder night, there are those that apply to the entire holiday week. The main week-long provision is the prohibition against leavening. This restriction is so strict that we are not even allowed to have such products in our possession. The severe punishment for eating leavening this week is that the Jew who would do so would be cut off from the Jewish people. Now, what is so bad about leavening? After all, we are told that we can eat it the rest of the year. For instance, the Shabbat loaves of bread are traditionally leavened, and there were leavened loaves used in the temple service, so why can't we eat it or even have it in our possession during the entire week of Passover? Also, there's an unusual custom to conduct a final check for this forbidden leavening on the night right before the holiday. To conduct this search, we use a candle, a wooden spoon, and a feather. Why? First, we must understand why leavening is forbidden during this week. The leavening agent causes the dough to rise. When bread is baked, the ingredients are simply flour, water, and yeast. Without the yeast, the bread would be flat, like matzah. Each leavened loaf looks differently than the next. It is almost as if each loaf has its own personality, but all matzahs look alike. It's hard to tell one from another. This is why leavening is forbidden this week. Passover is the holiday when we remember and stress how God took and continues to take us out of slavery. We can only go beyond our limitations, Egypt, when we nullify our wants. Big egos get stuck at the border. This means that we must become so humble that instead of pursuing our own personal agendas and their physical masters, we must choose to serve God and His spiritual agenda. This requires great humility and thanksgiving. Leavening does to flour and water just what our ego does to us. It puffs us up. Each loaf thinks it is beautiful, but really, except for the gas that the yeast put in there is just plain flour and water. So it is with us. If it were not for our ego, we would see ourselves to be mere flesh and bones, not such a big deal. Something alive today and gone tomorrow. So the special service of this holiday is to become a humble servant of God, a matzah instead of a big puffy loaf of farro. But what then of the candle, wooden spoon, and feather? They teach us a great lesson in how to get rid of our troublesome egos. When we start to clean our homes for Passover, we begin with the largest tools first, hired helpers, vacuum cleaners, sweepers, large brooms, shovels, strong detergents, and on. Then as the house becomes cleaner and cleaner, we use lighter tools, a dust cloth, a dustpan, sponges, paper towels, and such. We use smaller and lighter tools until we come to a candle in place of normal lighting, a small wooden spoon instead of a shovel, and a feather for a broom. Why? Just as when we clean our physical homes, we do not stop cleaning after one time over, but rather clean deeper and deeper, so much we clean our mental homes deeper and deeper. Just like when we found a lot of physical leavening and we kept looking for more, so must we do when we search for our spiritual leavening. When looking for our arrogance, we quickly find that big, main, obvious problem. Whoever honestly looks will see a big ego sticking up its foolish head. But you know what? Even after resolving to get rid of this major problem, there is still more to the search. We must look further. Look in the dark corners and you will find more things that you will want to get rid of. Then, after the final check, we tie up the remainder of the candle, the wooden spoon, the feather, and the leavening that we found in a paper bag. In the morning, we burn them with any other leavening and ego we have left in our possession. We say the appropriate prayers and feel really clean as we rush off to do the next thing on the long list of things that must be done that day before we can happily go out into freedom during the Seder that night. backward. There's an interesting custom observed at the Kotel. Upon leaving the Kotel area, we turn around and face the wall. Only then do we back away from the Kotel area. Some will back up all the way from the Kotel itself. Why? We see the answer to this question in this week's portion of the Torah. In the beginning of the portion, Moshe and Aaron go to Pharaoh and speak very harshly to him, warning him to do what God commanded, or else locusts will plague Egypt. Then they turned and left Pharaoh's presence. This was a sign of great disrespect. They turned their back to the king and walked away. If one were leaving a king's presence, he would back away slowly, keeping his eyes on the king. Perhaps the king would call him back. Perhaps the king might think he was rude if he turned his backside to him. Surely he would want to feast his eyes on the ruler as long as he could. When we stand at the Kotel, we are standing at a place where God's revealed presence has never left. If we would not turn our backs to an earthly king, then certainly we would not turn them from the heavenly king. A sign. The most exciting thing in this week's portion of the Torah is the Jewish nation's exodus from Egypt into freedom. A nation of lowly slaves marched out, heads held high, taking with them great riches, and this happened while the slave masters watched, totally defeated. At long last, after hundreds of years of exile and slavery, the exodus came. Hashem dealt out his last two plagues to the Egyptians, who finally allowed the Jewish nation to leave the horrible bondage that they had cruelly imposed upon them. Remember, the Torah is talking to us today, and the real message here is not merely the historical one, but the current one. When we rely on God and seek His ways, even today we can go out into freedom with riches while our enslavers stand helplessly watching us go. This is why we are told again and again to remember the exodus from slavery. This is not merely to give praise to Hashem for having taken our ancestors out of bondage, but to remember that He will do the same thing for us today when we follow His ways. In this portion, we are given some of the rules of the holiday of Passover, and we are told that its primary purpose is to remember our going out from slavery into freedom. We are also told about the mitzvah of tefillin, the leather boxes that we lay upon our arms and upon our heads. Here, too, we are told to remember our exodus into freedom. The holiday of Passover has obvious connections to the original Passover and, therefore, reminds us of our exodus. But what do tefillin have to do with the exodus? After all, isn't this just a ritual? Tefillin are called a sign or an ornament upon our head and are to be a reminder to study Torah. Placing words of Torah on our foreheads is certainly a reminder to study the Torah. But how are they an ornament? Tefillin are called a crown. The Talmud speaks of four crowns. There's the crown of Torah. This is the learning of the Torah. There's the crown of priesthood. This is the temple service and its equivalent today, which is prayer. There's a crown of kingship. This is the fulfilling of the mitzvah that go out into the kingdom, the world. Finally, there's the crown of a good name, which surpasses them all. This is chassidus, which leads a person to a spiritual life. Only the king wears the crown, but it is not for him to see. It is worn to identify him to others as the king. This is done for their benefit, because when they give honor to the king, there will be order and blessings in the kingdom. If you see a group of people praying, what religion would you say they must belong to? You cannot tell just from prayers, because all religions teach prayer. What if you see them burning incense? What religion would they have to belong to? You cannot say, because all religions burn incense. What if they are bowing down? Same thing. All religions teach their followers to bow down. Singing, same thing. Offering an animal, same thing. On and on until you see someone putting on tefillin. Ah, tefillin. This is the sign of a Jew. No one else in the entire world, not in its entire history, has ever adopted the custom of tefillin except the Jews. To this day, they are a sign, a crown that is placed upon our heads, the heads of his people, to identify us as the ones he has taken out and does take out of slavery.
Thereisone.com